Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, yeah, A-Dream, in the building, shout out to Bree.
What up, Bree?
And we finna go in, look.
Yes, sir.
Look, we came to break down a few topics here. So if you got time, sit and acknowledge it. Positive, uplifting, and honest here. Keep your ears open and soaking all the words spoken. A couple of jokes to keep it fun, get your laugh on. And maybe a few pointers to get your cash on. See Bree, she all about building. Straight up out the NY, Brooklyn in the building. All the way down to the southern states. West Coast on up to the Great Lakes. So you fragging echoes, so if you ain't fragile, through the net connection, we streaming you the message.
So welcome to the life of Bree, breaking down relationships to the third degree.
This is the Bree life, what you live in life.
Welcome to the Bree life,
how we live in life.
From politics to the current events, economics to race, whether you're poor or you're rich.
This is the Bree life, what you live in life.
Welcome to the Bree life,
how we live in life.
Coming to you live and streaming to all four points of the globe. It's your girl, Brooklyn born and Crown Heights raised. Living life and breathing life. It's Bree, baby.
Peace and blessings. You have reached the Bree Life Radio Show, and I'm your host, Bree. And tonight, we have a great show for you lined up. We're talking about what does it mean to be black in America now. This is a show that was developed basically because there was discussion that was had on our Freestyle Thursday show that was quite inflamed with energetic ideas and perspectives on race. So I thought it was important that we continue the dialogue and expanded on it a little bit, but got to its core. So I want to welcome all my listeners and the guest panel that's going to be participating tonight and my guest callers to this most needed discussion. What I want to start by saying is, you know, a wise man listens to his critics. This is something that I've learned personally over the last couple of weeks. So I just want you all to know that I'm listening. It has been said in my presence by two African-American men that they didn't consider themselves black men, but an American. And I have to tell you, this was a little surprising to me, but I respect where the brothers were coming from. The fact is that these two happen to be men of color living in America. And I beg to differ that still in America today, for those of us who are of color or so-called African Americans, we don't have the same access, or we can say whether or not we experience liberty, equality, or justice if it's accessible for all of us. For this, it's my belief, as I know other brothers and sisters of mine, and they would agree, that where love and life is, so is justice, freedom, and equality. It's also present. So, for my listeners that have followed the show from the beginning, they know that it's been the show. The show has, for the most part, been a platform to discuss issues that have greatly affected men and women of color. I've said constantly during the airing of the show that men and women don't communicate well. You know that I tend to be animated at times, and I think I've even more expressed it colorfully that our communication sucks. So due to the events of in my own life with regards to my relationships and my identity as a woman of color, It has forced me to take further examination of what does it really mean to be black in America now. But more granularly, I felt the need for examination because I realized that the real or the root cause is systemic with self-hatred. The sickness of what the Willie Lynch syndrome has done to us is still present and is still with us. There are some men and women of color that have an innate self-hatred, and it is my belief that this is why our relationships are in discord. There are some of us that would suggest that we should end our discussion about racism because we have a president who looks like us. But Dr. King says that if we do not deal with the truth, you will lose the moral authority. So let me be clear by saying I love my people. Let me be clear also and say that I do not hate white people. But we have to stop focusing on white people and begin to work on ourselves and restore our self-esteem so that we can work on our agenda and repair our relationships. So tonight I will be asking my guest panel several questions beyond what does it mean to be black in America now. So let's examine that. So tonight we're going to be joined by two men that I've come to have a great respect for as a result of conversations and more so what I've had the opportunity to think and feel about those conversations afterwards. Stephen Davis, he is the CEO and founder of the Black Education Network. He has also been an adjunct professor of two institutes of higher learning. He's also a community and civil rights activist. Dr. Jeremy Hackley, he's a pastor in D.C. He studied at the Helen Burke Theological Institute. He's wrote several books, but more specifically, the book that we're going to sort of be referencing tonight is The Letter, the Hackley Exhaustive Work on the Willie Lynch Letters. But before I move along, I am going to bring on one of our quite noted guest callers. Of course, he is Mark in Houston, Texas. Brother Mark.
Sister Bree, what's going on?
Peace and blessings.
Peace and blessings.
How are you tonight?
I am well. I am doing well. And yourself?
I'm great. Well, you know what the topic of tonight is, and I think you probably understand even more so intimately why there was a need to have this expansive discussion, because where we left off on Thursday with the discussion about race and racism.
Definitely. I mean, it's heightenedly, you know, especially with the advent of recent events in the last month or so with the Trayvon Martin situation, that there's a lot of feelings about how people of color or people that look like you and I are fearing in this country and where it's stemming from. So There's been a lot of conversation concerning racism and inequalities in the justice system. And then we had conversations on last week that talked about the lack of support in the black community. You mentioned, I think, something about how we, meaning people of color, are spending their money or not spending their money, where they're spending their money or not spending their money, how they're caring for each other and not caring for each other. You brought up the issue of self-hate, and you use example about, again, not to particularly point out, but because you said you grew up in, because you have grown up in the Crown Heights area, and y'all talk about Hasidic Jews and how they spent their money with each other in their shop and so forth and so on. And the questions were, why weren't we supporting each other? So, yeah, we had a real heated exchange at the end of last Thursday's show concerning what it was to be black in America. And then, and not only that, people use different terms. Some folks want to be called African-American. Other folks want to be black American. Other folks want to be called of color. Then we want to use the word black or African when they use when they refer to themselves. So, you know, that's what I remember. So,
well, for the record, I wanna be clear on how I feel about the labels. I guess because of my very ethnic diverse background, and because I had the father who happens to be Egyptian, and my last name being Hassan, it's not been a very easy cross to bear having this last name. As I was talking with Dr. Hackley earlier, I told him very honestly that my whole life I've been proud of my heritage, but of recent years post 9/11, it's always been very difficult having the last name Hassan. For some reason, people have put me in positions where they felt that I needed to give them an explanation for who and what and my last name actually meant. I find there's moments when I found great offense to that. I guess maybe because of how they approached me. My father always, he taught me from a little girl, you know, to be proud of who I am, of my multicultural ethnicity, of being of African ancestry. So even though I don't particularly like the label of African American, but right now I embrace it because it's the one that I can adapt to. The label of being black it's a little difficult for me, not because I don't accept being of color, but anyone who's seen a picture of me, the only thing that is black about me is my hair. My skin is definitely not black. So associating, saying that I'm black, I don't particularly like taking on that label, but I do accept it. So labels don't really work well with me. So you'll more often hear me refer to myself as a woman of color, and I'm good with that. And I hope that most are good with that, and for those who are not, they, you know, that's their thing. So.
All right.
That's where we are tonight. As we're waiting for Dr. Hackley and Stephen Davis to come on the line, I think we should go to some callers and see what's been going on and where they're coming from on the topic that we're discussing tonight. And our next caller that I'm going to bring on is a very good friend of mine, a friend for unbelievably 40 years. His name is Alex Leaf, and I refer to him as my brother because other than my brother, he knows me just as long as he does. So, Alex, peace and blessings. How are you tonight?
I'm great. What up, Bree? What's up, Mark? What's good?
What's up, Alex? How you feeling, brother?
Oh, man, I'm awesome. I'm kind of amped, ready for this topic.
Well, as we're waiting for our esteemed guest panel to arrive, let's have some discussion on what our topic is about tonight. I mean, Alex, when you discovered that this was a topic, and you were on last week's Freestyle Thursday show, so you know how heated it was, how inflammatory the discussion was towards the last half hour. So, and we've had some discussions several times between Thursday and this afternoon. Tell me what you think about the subject matter. Tell me what you feel, especially being in the working in the industry in which you work in. For the listeners, this is my friend Alex Leith. He is the owner and producer of Links Court Productions. He's a television and movie producer, and
yep.
He's also an African American man living in America. So, tell me, how do you feel about being black in America now?
Well, the first thing I want to say, and I want to say this to all my white family out there who may be listening, because quite frankly, I have a lot of white friends that I'm very fond of, that are very
mm-hmm.
fond of me, actresses, business associates, close friends, and so forth. So I want to make them aware that this is not so much against them as it is
no.
for us.
No,
okay?
This is in love. For us.
Right, it's for us. So this is not against, you know, my white family. I love them dearly. And but this is more so for us because we're lost in a lot of ways, and it's just becoming more and more evident. We should be past these things in 2012, but apparently we're not. So when you ask me the question, what does it mean being black in America right now, typically for me, it means, you know, tackling unprecedented adversity still, facing seemingly insurmountable odds, understanding white supremacy and trying to find ways to navigate around and through it if necessary, understanding that you are a target of law enforcement every time you step out of your door in the morning just because you're a person of color or darker complexion.
Uh-huh.
I had to have a discussion with my son earlier this week. Because with all this Trayvon Martin stuff going on, my son is 15 now. And I had
uh-huh.
to explain to him how to address him, how to behave when a cop approaches him, when to throw him up against the car or whatever the case, how to be polite, be respectful to the officer, because you don't want to set them off, because their first reaction is to shoot you.
That's
okay?
Right.
It's a shame we have to have these discussions with our children, because I beg to differ. I don't think white fathers and white mothers have these discussions with their sons. Because
uh-huh.
because I challenge you to find me one incident of an accidental shooting between a white cop and a young white boy like we have faced time and time again over the years. I challenge you to find me one. Okay? You're
absolutely
not going
right.
to hear those kind of stories. You're not going to hear those kind of stories. It only happens to us. And that stuff starts from the top down because they're not taught etiquette and how to deal with other ethnicities. They don't have that training on dealing with other ethnicities that don't look like them, may respond differently in certain situations, whatever. Their first reaction is to shoot. They're afraid of us for some reason. So we have to start to try to, you know, knock some of those walls down. Quite frankly, we don't behave properly as black people or black males a lot of ways ourselves. You know, we don't garner the respect we should have because we don't give it to ourselves. You mentioned
uh-huh.
self-hatred. It's a big problem with that, and we'll get more into that as the show go on. But what are
okay.
you guys' responses to some of the things I just said?
Well, I'm going to digress and direct to Mark because, I mean, like yourself, I also have a 15-year-old son, but I'll talk about that in a few moments. I know Mark, he has two sons. One of his sons who I'm quite fond of both of them, but as most people may or may not know, the Bree Life radio show song is being rapped by Mr. Mark's son, A Dream, because everybody got a dream. Shout out to my young man A Dream out there in the airways doing wonderful things. He just came out with a new video that everyone's got to go out there and watch on YouTube. But we'll talk about that later. Mark, talk about having two sons young men in America right now and navigating and trying to, you know, what did you do with regards to what Alex just talked about?
Well, I'm from Chicago originally, but my children and my sons and my daughter, they were mostly raised in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And what some people might not know, that Minneapolis is, shall I say, the 7-county metro area that includes Minneapolis and St. Paul. It's 7% black, which makes it, for an area that has over 2 million plus inhabitants, it's the, I guess you would call it, the whitest major metropolitan area in the United States. And the area that we lived in, basically, of course, he grew up in around a bunch of white people, went to school with a large amount of white people when he was in elementary school, Mark and Alan, which are both my sons, and Crystal, which is my daughter. And he's 20, my oldest son, Mark, is 25. My son, Alan, which is A-Dream, the rapper, he's 23, he'll be 24 next month. And my daughter, who is a junior at the University of Houston, is 20 years old, be 21 this year. So they grew up most of their life.
Was a very talented, mind you.
Yep. So they grew up around the majority of white people. I mean, so, you know, they went to school with them. Some of their best friends were white, you know. And so the weird part about it is they were highly aware of being black more so when they got older, because young kids growing up with other young kids don't always understand or even process. So unless there's some kind of pivotal event that takes place, they don't really know that. And knock on wood, we didn't really have to deal with any issues, they didn't anyway, concerning a race. I mean, my understanding to them was that, hey, you know, you need to be polite. You need to be aware of your surroundings. I don't think until my sons got to really be teens did we ever have conversations concerning the issue of police, because by the time we got to teens and we moved to Minneapolis, because we were living in Maplewood, Minnesota, which was a suburb of St. Paul, when we moved to the city, to the north side of Minneapolis, that's when we kind of got more into the police issues, because not so much because of police, we were dealing with the issue of the gangs, and it's heavily infiltrated on the north side of Minneapolis. There's a lot of gangs. So we had conversations concerning the police at that point, because they were becoming aware of friends of theirs that were being arrested and selling drugs and various other things. So at that point, we had conversations about what you need to do when you encounter a police officer. I got to admit, though, that was basically what we had, those kind of conversations at that point, so.
Okay. Mark, I want to just ask you to pause. We're going to go to a commercial, and then that's going to be a perfect setup segue into the next part of the discussion, because I have a friend by the name of QB. He's a police officer in Chicago, and we're going to bring him on the line, and we're going to talk about being black in America now, the crime in Chicago, how that affects the city, how does that affect how people are looking at themselves. So we're going to go to our commercial, and we will be right back.
If you didn't tune into the Bree Life radio show on Wednesday, this is what you missed.
Hey, Mark. Mark, yeah, check it out, Mark. If they give it up too easy sometimes, I mean, if vagina was a stock, it would plummet. It would plummet.
Mm.
Because you give it away too easy.
You hear that, ladies? There is a brother on the line that's saying that the ladies are giving it up too easy.
And this?
We want a lot more than sex, too. We want to be loved. We want to be respected. We want a whole lot of that will make the sexual experience that much more enhanced.
We can't forget about this.
Tony, you heard that. You know she's taking the easy way out of this one. You know, come on, Bree.
No, listen. I say you have to be honest. You have to be honest with your partner of what the deal breakers are.
It's real talk about real life. Inhale and breathe light.
No, we breathing light. We ain't breathing heavy now. Right.
It's the Bree Life Radio Show on Blog Talk Radio. Catch us at blogtalkradio.com/Bree Life.
And we're back. You're back on the Bree Life Radio Show. Tonight our discussion is about what does it mean to be black in America now? And we're going to pick up where you left off, Mark, but we're going to bring on the line a very good friend of mine who is by the name of QB, my favorite quarterback from Chicago, who happens to be a police officer. So we're going to bring him on the line and get his perspective. QB?
Yes, yes. How you doing?
How are you? Peace and blessings.
Peace and blessings. How you doing?
Great. You're on the line with Alex and Mark. And you know
what
our topic is. We're talking about what does it mean to be black in America now? And I know that you've been listening for a few minutes. You've been in the queue. So you've heard both Alex and Mark's comments about preparing their sons for the reality of having to encountering law enforcement and how to be prepared for that because of what happens at times. And if you can share with us, you know, some of your feelings about that, especially being a law enforcement officer in Chicago, tell us what you encounter.
Well,
how you feel about being black in America now.
What I feel about being, that's very controlled. You know, that's how I feel about being black in America. I mean, it's a very controlled environment and unfair. I want to say that about that part of it. But as far as teaching, you know, younger males how to respect, you know, law enforcement figures. You know, you have
and not just how to respect, but to how to be responsive, how to respond when having to encounter.
Right. You know, you have to look at the bigger picture of that. Maybe that individual, because you got good and bad in everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you don't want if you're encountering one that is bad, you have to try to do, you know, win that person over, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
You have to outthink that individual, and sometimes that may be just, you know, ignoring the ignorance that is being, you know, brought your way. You just ignore it and try to do what they're telling you to do. Because a lot of times they are still going to give you, you know, like if you're speeding or whatever it is you're doing, whatever reason it is that they stopped you, go ahead and acknowledge it. And, you know, try not to say, you know, anything against what they're saying to get it over with. Because 9 times out of 10, that would de-escalate the situation. Don't fuel it, in other words. You know, and sometimes that doesn't always work. But you do want to at least try to defuse it that way.
Right.
You know, in certain circumstances like Trayvon, you know, just it's nothing you could do in that type of situation. That was just dead wrong. Okay. But if you can, you know, one thing you want to try to teach the younger generation of men is to, even though it may be unfair, don't jump the gun and try to, you know, go against them and tell them it's unfair. You know, just try to stay calm. That's the best thing you could do.
And Zimmerman's no cop.
I'm sorry?
No, I'm saying Zimmerman is no cop, the guy that shot Trayvon.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But I thought she was asking me about
law enforcement figures and what to teach younger men as far as them being unfair. Now, that's why I said in that situation, that's totally different. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mark, would you like to continue on with your point that you were making about your sons? And one thing I want to also give you the opportunity to express, because some people may not have been listening last week. So if you could just tell us about your feelings about what it is to be black in America now.
Right. Well, I tell you, back to what I was saying about the whole police thing, and I hear what QB is saying. My thing is, I don't know that you're going to always, if you got a hot-headed cop that wants to trip out on you, I guess they're going to. But my belief is these are the men in authority, whatever color the cop is. Therefore, they're going to get the utmost unbelievable respect and cooperation out of me. You know, that's just my theory. Because guess what? I've been stopped by black cops a lot. Just for, you know, just for speeding or for the regular normal stop, your light is out or whatever the case may be. And the reality is this, I don't care what the color cop is, I'm a consummate gentleman because he's authority. And it's almost kind of like if your mom comes into the room and she says, girl, what you doing? Boy, what you doing? You're going to be, yes, ma'am. That's kind of how I am. He's the authority. So I got the respect for the authority and the position. I'm in a weaker position. So I won't submit. So that's
but
kind
you know,
of my
Mark,
position. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, Mark, and I just want to cut in on you real quick for a second. The abuse of that authority is the question. Because I'm gonna address this to Brother QB on the line because he is a law enforcement officer. And I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, concrete jungle. New York is always hot, hot spot for everything, okay? And Brooklyn is even a hotter spot. Bree knows because she's from Brooklyn, okay? And in my encounters, when you have a patrol car coming down the street, usually there's two police officers in the car. You got one, if you got one black, one white cop, and they patrol in a black neighborhood, from my experiences, the black cop is always the bigger butthole than the white cop toward black people because he has to prove to his white partner that he's not giving black people a pass. But from what I found is that the same white partner, when he's interacting with white folks who may have ran a stop sign or whatever, he has no problem with giving them a slap on the wrist in front of his black partner. So why do we feel like as black officers with a white partner, we got to be double the buttholes to our own people than they are to theirs? Because most of the captains or the chiefs are white? I mean, what's the issue with that?
Well, I mean, the thing that I see is that's when we get into what it is to be black in America. And I believe all of this is taught. You know, all of the bad things that we do in America as African-Americans are taught. Everything we do, from the clothes we wear, from the language we speak, to the food we eat, all of this is taught. And the gangs, all these things are taught. See, Al Capone, those are original gangsters. These little guys you see on the corner, they're copycats. All these things that we're speaking of right now is taught. Mm-hmm. These are, you know, and these are the things that we need to address and kind of, I guess, give wisdom to these younger brothers. And that's what we need to do. We need to bring all that into the open because I don't think they see it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, just to address both of you, two different things. I heard what you were saying, and Alex, and for me, growing up over there on the south side, I remember we had two cops called Stickman and Cowboy, both black officers. Dudes were known to be dirty dudes. I mean, they did things like grab one of us and they'll take us from, I live on 80th and Colfax, and they'll take me over off of a commercial area where there was Hispanics and drop us off over there. And it happens to too many of us when, you know, they'll rouse the corner. We stand, they stand in front of the corner on Kingston, in front of the liquor store. They clear the corner. They grab a couple young men that they may feel they did some things or they've arrested in the past, throw them in the back of the car. Next thing you know, they didn't take them to the precinct. They dropped them off. And we know that for sure because with too many of them stories that happened, they were black cops on black people. But let me move to another thing. When I hear what QB is saying, it brings to my mind this. It's this whole issue of law and order and expectations in the society, you know. And the reality is this, is that the numbers in prison suggest, there's no doubt about it, that there's an exorbitant number of us who are in jail. I was looking at a statistic. They say between the ages of 25 and 29, black men between the ages of 25 and 29, that's 10% of black men between that age group are representative in the incarceration, and as far as being incarcerated. So that's a large amount of those. Quentin said something about Al Capone. My thing about that is that hooliganism, criminal enterprise, and doing dirt, whether it's done on a colossal level as the mafia or as the little guy on the corner, to me it ain't no different. So to me, they're the same to me. I don't differentiate between Al Capone except for the scale.
Okay.
I mean, Al Capone was riding down the street shooting, just like these young men were running down the street shooting. And sometimes they were innocent bystanders.
You know what?
Sometimes it wasn't. So.
But that's in
I'm going to ask you all to pause. We're going to go to commercial break. And when we come back, we will be bringing on the very esteemed Dr. Hackley, who is one of our guest panelists this evening. So I need for everyone to exhale and breathe light, and we'll be back in a minute.
If you didn't tune into the Bree Life Radio Show on Wednesday, this is what you missed.
Hey, Mark, check it out, Mark. If.
Yeah, yeah. Adrian in the building. Shout out to Bree.
What up, Bree?
And we're gonna go in.
Hello,
look,
sir.
Look. Yeah, yeah.
It's the Bree Life Show.
You gotta turn on.
When Bree lights up,
you gotta turn on.
It's the Bree Life Show.
You gotta turn her on. The Bree Life, the Bree Life. You gotta turn her on.
It's the Bree Life Show.
You gotta turn her on.
When Bree lights up,
you gotta turn her on.
It's the Bree Life Show.
You gotta turn her on. The Bree Life, the Bree Life. You gotta turn her on.
Tune in Wednesday and Thursday nights, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, for real talk about real life. Inhale and breathe light. It's the Bree Life Radio Show on blogtalkradio.com/BRILIFE.
It's the Bree Life Show.
Well, we're back, and that was my special mix for those who are just tuning in. Thank you for tuning in. You have reached the Bree Life Radio Show, and I'm your host, Bree. And next, we are bringing on Dr. Hackley. So without further ado, let's bring him on. Peace and blessings,
hello.
Dr. Hackley.
Yes, peace and blessings. How are you, Bree?
I am wonderful. I'm blessed and highly favored, and we're all blessed and highly favored for having you join us tonight.
Absolutely. I'm so glad to be here, coming to you from Washington, D.C. We are just a few minutes away from the Capitol, and of course there's a lot going on in America right now because George Zimmerman has been arrested, as I hear, coming out of church tonight, and it is a very strategic time for us to be having this kind of conversation about what it means to be black in America today. So I'm glad to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you. Dr. Hackley, if you could just give our listeners a little background information on, you know, who you are, what you're doing in your community. And one of the reasons why I wanted to bring you on the show was because as we talked this, we had an opportunity to talk this afternoon, I shared with you that I'm, you know, looking at our experience of as people of color, and like I was telling you, the how the show began, and one of the the things that provoke me to do the shows, because being a single woman of color in America dating, I realized that I was beginning to see that there was a pattern. Not just a pattern in me, a pattern in my colleagues that are women, a pattern in friends and family members that are women, and we all kind of had the same complaint. And then I had friends that were that are men, and we're all having the same complaint that there's a communication breakdown. But then I thought about it, and in talking with one of our guest callers, who I'm going to introduce you to in a moment, Mark from Houston, Texas, he and I have had hours and hours of conversation and debate on relations between men and women of color in America, and we both walked away with feeling that the problem went a little further. It was that it's not just that we don't communicate well, but that we don't have a willingness to communicate at times. So, but then I've had further time to examine it, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to bring you on the show. And I realized that beyond that, we have a self-hatred as people of color, and which segues into one of the books that you've written. And if you could take the time to introduce yourself to our listeners and the panel and tell us about the book.
Yes, I am Dr. Jeremiah C. Hackley from Washington, D.C., pastor of Dominion City Church. We also are serving the community through various mediums like the Father Still program, which helps fathers to develop strong parenting skills for their relationships with their children, as well as the single fathers and the homes that are co-parented from two different homes, but we had single mothers. But we also, I've written a book just recently called The Letter. It is Hackley's exhaustive commentary on the Willie Lynch letter. Again, that name is The Letter, Hackley's exhaustive commentary on the Willie Lynch letter. And I wrote that book about the challenges or definitive perspectives in the modern African-American experience. What happens is I've taken the Willie Lynch letter and I've broken it down into 247 verses and 9 chapters. And in breaking that down into 247 verses and 9 chapters, we find that I can address the challenges in the community from a point-by-point basis. And, of course, there's a lot of controversy over the authenticity of the letter. But what stands true is that the letter the symptoms that are described in the letter are very prevalent in our community, especially when it concerns communication skills. And I believe personally that the breakdown in communication that goes on between the male and the female, the male, the grandparent to the grandchildren, the mother to the child, all of the communication challenges that are going on are a result of social programming for the economic good of those who have enslaved us through what I call protracted slavery over the last 400 years, because it is not just a physical situation, it is a psychological situation that has been hovering over the mind of the people for the last 4 centuries. And so I address all of these things in the book. You can get it at Amazon.com. You can also get it at Xulon Press. That's Xulon Press.com. You can go to our website, which is www.kingdomculture.tv, and you can find it there. But again, it's The Letter, Hackley's Exhaustive Commentary on the Willie Lynch Letter, Definitive Perspectives in the Modern African-American Experience. But to just give some light to the breakdown in communication, we are dealing with a generation that is, you know, some of our last civil rights heroes and people who were alive during the time of slavery, or children of those who are alive during the time of slavery are beginning to die. And so many of the traditions and customs and stories and even the things that kept families together and the modes of preservation are being lost really to the lack of communication on a broader range between the generations. And therein we suffer, you know, in our intimate relationships and our parenting relationships with the lack of communication, because the custom and the tradition of how we communicate with each other culturally is beginning to be just dismantled by the programming of the media and different things. And so the challenge that we face on the local level is a bigger issue, because we are challenged with a lot that is being given to us. I see that we have very little self-definition for our relationships, or even for ourselves. We base it off or compare it to what we are programmed to compare ourselves to through media and economics, things of this kind of thing. And so our cultural heritage is kind of lost, and the things that we value are kind of lost in the comparisons to how we define ourselves, what love is, what intimacy is, what sexuality is, what these things are. And we find it challenging to take these definitions that have been given to us through other mediums and integrated into our reality as African Americans in the country. And so defining ourselves is very key in the communication barrier, because you know, I used to say this: you can only be in a relationship with someone you relate to, and you can only relate to someone to the level or dimension that you know yourself. So if you don't know yourself, you don't really have the power to relate to someone else, because you are basing it off of their perspective or their perception of you. So that's a little thought in a nutshell.
Okay, and let me just ask you this: how do you feel right now in America as a black man? How do you view yourself today? To where you are in society, how the system or the capitalistic system that we live under affects you, affects where you see yourself going. Give us a little background on that, because that's really what the theme of the show is about, and then we're going to talk about your book, because I really want to touch on some things, since it's my belief, and I think I have the support of the other members of our guest caller panel that say and also share the belief that there's a lot of self-hatred that is innate in who we are as people. So just tell me, what do you think it is to be black in America today?
To be black in America is it's a double-edged sword. It's a great opportunity right now to be authentic, but it's also a very dangerous thing to be authentic at the same time. As a black man myself, I've tasted the dimensions of the system that are just poisonous and ravenous to my manhood and my my authenticity. But I've also begin to see that if nobody stands up for what is wrong or what the challenges are, that my son will be lost, and there will be others that are coming behind me that's being lost. So I'm offered an opportunity to be a leader. So that's a great thing, because there's some things that certain people are just born for, and if there weren't certain problems, then there wouldn't be a need for what I have to offer to the community. So I see it as a good thing, because what God has put in me is necessary for the generation that I've been born into, but at the same time, I am not clouded in my judgment as to the reality of the challenges that we face on a regular basis within the system and the daily challenges that go on. So, you know, as a father, I know what it is to deal with teachers and people who have certain expectation of your children and challenges, and they don't really know your children, and so they try to kind of pass the buck. I know what it is to deal with, you know, the challenges of a relationship of someone who has not been developed for the long term, and to deal with those kind of things in a relationship or in a marriage. I know what that is. I know what it is to suffer under the expectation of programming and really not have the authenticity in the home that you desire. But again, these things come from the lack of training and the absence of training in a lot of instances. And so you know, it's a self-taught kind of path that has to be walked in this time and this season. And that's something that I'm learning, that I'm beginning to learn that other people have to begin to look within, to really define, because there's so many definitions for what it means to be African American in this hour, at this time, and so many people have various perspectives, and I am in no wise looking for the community to be monolithic in its definition, or look for one leader. I am very much an encourager of multiple, you know, paths in the same direction, if you will, or being able to have diversity in the definition. But the one thing that I do say is that we all are at a challenge. We all are at a challenge here in 2012, and we have suffered enough, and we have to begin to hold our community accountable, and even the system accountable to our existence in this culture. And so we have more power, more information, more ability to do that than we ever had before. We just have to be inspired to utilize what is available to us.
Okay. I want to take this time to introduce you to our esteemed guest callers.
Okay.
We have on the line Mark from Houston, Texas. If you could give Dr. Hackley a hello.
How's it going?
Hey, Brother Mark.
And we also have QB in Chicago, Illinois.
Hey, how you doing, brother? How you feel?
Hey, excellent, brother. Excellent.
Okay. And we have Alex, who is in Hampton, Virginia.
Hey, Dr. Happy. I'm actually in Virginia Beach. How you doing, brother?
I'm actually, man. It's good weather down there. Good weather down there.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Well, I've had an opportunity to talk to some of the panelists, some of the guest callers today to talk about the fact that you were coming on the show and to share some of your ideologies and perspectives on people of color and our condition in America today, and to talk about the book that you've written that references the Willie Lynch letter. And I'm going to turn it over to Alex at this point. Alex, do you have any questions for Dr. Hackley?
Yes. I'd like to address a few things to Dr. Hackley. One, I want to commend you for addressing this Willie Lynch syndrome in the way you have addressed it, and I have to make it, you know, my business to get a copy of your book. I believe that 2013, which is next year, I think will be 300 years from the day that Willie Lynch has said, when he trained the slave masters on how to break slaves when he just got here from Jamaica, he said, if you do this right, if you do what I'm telling you to do and you do it right, before they realize what hit them, maybe 300 years before they figure this out. And I think 2013
actually, it's this year.
It's this year, brother.
It's actually, it's 2012. We are in that year, and I addressed I addressed the importance of this year and the ramifications of what we do in this year, and how should I talk about everything from Obama to what's going on the local level. It's really this year. We are 300 years from the date of the letter, which was written in 1712.
Right. Okay. Wow. Okay. Well, that's awesome. And what I wanted to further impress upon you, I knew it was about 300 years. I knew we were close. Thanks for clarifying that. I have a neighbor, Dr. Hackley. Very pretty dark skinned girl. Beautiful mm-hmm. dark skinned girl lives next door to me. This girl, if she was any darker, she'd be purple. Okay? But she's mm-hmm. a beautiful girl, okay? She don't have a black friend, not one, that I've seen that comes visit with her, or her boyfriends are white, her girlfriends are white, her entire circle is white. It almost mm-hmm. appears as though she has totally disassociated herself from the black culture. My mm-hmm. brother-in-law, my wife's brother, lives in Sacramento. He exclusively dates white women. His whole association mm-hmm. are white people. He sent us a picture of him at the Thanksgiving dinner last year. About 12, 13 people in the room. He's the only black person in the room. And he don't see a problem with this. I don't believe my neighbor sees a problem with it. Why in 2012, 300 years from Willie Lynch letter, we still don't see a problem with that?
Well, I want to say this, and I'm just going to read what Lynch said. I'm just going to read what he said, and it's going to clarify some things. It said, and I'm reading verse 25 through, and I broke it up into verses. And so when I say verse, you may not see it online as verse and chapter, but you'll be able to see it in the book as verse and chapter. But it says this, 25 says, the black slaves, after receiving this indoctrination, shall carry on and will become self-refueling for hundreds of years, maybe thousands. Now, 26 says, don't forget that you must pitch the old black male versus the young black male against the old black male. 27 says, you must use the dark-skinned slaves versus the light-skinned slaves and the light-skinned slaves versus the dark-skinned slaves. You must use the male versus the female and the female versus the male. You must also have white servants and overseers who distrust all blacks. But it is necessary that your slaves trust and depend only on us. They must love, respect, and trust only us. Gentlemen, these are your keys to control. Use them. Have your wives and children use them. Never miss an opportunity. If intensely used for 1 year, the slaves themselves will become perpetually distrustful of each other. Thank you, gentlemen. And basically what he's saying is if we can create the variance between the sexes, create the variance between the variations of the skin color and things of this nature, if we can do this for 1 year intensely, they will become perpetually self-refueling in the indoctrination, which is to hate themselves, hate their brother, hate their own kind, and really, in a nutshell, the reason why you have the sister next door and you have the brother in the other state that deals with that is because they have been socialized and indoctrinated to relate. What he said clearly is love and respect and trust only us. And so their love, their intimacy, their fraternity, their camaraderie, that definition of love, trust, and respect, all of that dimension has become defined by whatever European culture projects upon us as our reality. And so when you're dealing with that, you're dealing with someone who is a perfect product of what the intent of the indoctrination of the Lynch was to the African American people. Does that answer your question, brother? Hello? Are we still on?
Alex?
Are we still there?
Okay, I don't know if we...
Okay.
Alex, I'm here.
Dr. Hackley asked you if that answered your question.
Yes, you answered my question. Absolutely, I appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Somebody has noise in their background, Bree. Who's that?
Whoever has the noise in their background, could they put their phone on mute to whatever's going on in the background?
Okay.
I'm going to now turn the questions over to Mark in Houston, Texas. Mark, do you have a question or questions you'd like to ask Dr. Hackley at this time?
Well, I don't know if I have a question. There's just some interesting points that I just noticed between what Brother Alex said and what
Brother Hackley just said. My concern is this. Willie Lynch, I'm well acquainted with it. Actually, I did a couple groups on it, and I used to do a lot of teaching in groups up in Minneapolis, and I work with a lot of kids on it. My thing is this. As we continue to move towards the next 100 years or so, the issue of race, which we've used and actually have been used upon us, and that means, you know, when they talk about race, talk about Mongoloid, Caucasoid, Negroid, and some people even talk about Australoid. My issue is this. The concept of purity and race based upon this concept of color is ever-changing. I just was talking about being from the Minneapolis area and the fact that my kids grew up around a lot of quote-unquote Caucasians, the fact that a lot of Caucasians and our young people are intermingling, and if we look at the next 100 or so years, the concept of purity amongst race, if it's not already eliminated, not to mention the fact that me being down in Houston, Texas, and I'm right on the border of Mexico, and I'm seeing the influx and the majority change, we're seeing a difference when it comes to what it means to see even black. Because I'm seeing different colors, and so now the question as to self-hatred, if you want to call it, because I don't know, is it self-hatred if a black man gets with a white woman? Is it self-hatred if a white woman gets with a black man? You know, and I don't know. And then I think about King, and I think about the fact that Martin Luther King and Malcolm X went through some of their biggest trials, and especially Malcolm, once he came back from Mecca and saw what he saw in as far as the striations of color, he started seeing, wait a minute, even his religion of Islam and being a Muslim was not exclusive to a color. And then even when Martin Luther King started advocating the concept of neither black or white, Jew or Gentile, Protestant or Catholic, this whole kind of this whole melting pot of God's children, we started running into a whole different concern, because black separatists didn't support that no more than white supremacy. And then both of those men, that was at the point that they of their demise, once they stopped purporting this whole concept of unity. So my question to Brother Hackley is this. If we're dealing with a group of people that are constantly intermixing and intermingling, how do we continue to apply some of these concepts of slavery, which came out of the whole Willie Lynch paper era, to the next 100 years or so?
I think that the issue of race, the issue of race in this country, is something that can't go away until we address the reality of how it came in the first place. And this is one thing that comes to my mind. There was so many people that came here on the Atlantic Ocean, came here over the Atlantic Ocean and have died. And I say this a lot, and the blood of the innocent blood of people who were en route to this place and the people who came to this place, you know, as slaves, that blood is turning over and turning over and turning over in our society. And I equate it to the blood of Abel that scripturally that cries from the ground for the injustice that's been done to it. And so I say this a lot of times, that African-Americans hurt from a place that they cannot put their finger on it. But to me, it's the blood of Abel that's crying for justice to be done in the place of injustice. I don't think it's a race issue as much as it's a justice issue. You know, there are other people who have migrated to this country and able to capitalize off of the economy and other things like that. And we know that discrimination has been very real when it concerns everything from credit to jobs and all of that kind of stuff. And so when we're dealing with the realities of race challenges in the culture, I'm not necessarily concerned with whether a white man is walking down the street with a black woman or vice versa. My major concern, because everybody has a prerogative of their own self-definition and their own path and their own route to know themselves. But the challenge is that we are in a time where that definition has to be addressing the injustice that has gotten us to the place that we are. And if y'all got to excuse me because I'm around family at the same time that I'm talking tonight, but I want you to really get that the injustice is the issue. That's a reality for many of us at this point. And I'm not saying that to walk. If I were to walk around with a white woman, I don't think that I would be in the dimension of self-hatred. You know, people find solace in people, and they find relationships to be therapeutic to whatever psychological or emotional injury they've encountered. And so they make choices based on some of those decisions, or they just are raised with that kind of adaptivity to be able to be in a relationship with someone of another race. And so it's not necessarily self-hatred is to blame at this juncture when it concerns that. But I do believe that a value needs to be put on the preservation of relationships within the culture.
Well, if I may interject, I just have a feeling about what our brother Mark has just said, because I've heard him say it before, and I don't necessarily agree with him in the sense that I think it is important for us to recognize that regardless of the other ethnicities that are becoming larger, let's say, for instance, the Latino group of people that reside in America, we can't worry about where race is going.
Right.
I think we have to be very concerned right now where we are with race and where we are with racism in the country now. But more importantly, so back to the point and back to the topic of the show, to deal with the self-hatred, because there is repair that needs to be done internally in us individually. We can't, until we face that, until we deal with that, no relationship that we have with the opposite sex, with our family, work in a work environment, nothing is going to be right.
Right.
And that is where we're talking about, or why we're talking about, the programming or the deprogramming that needs to take place. So
exactly.
I understand Mark's point about eventually, you know, somewhere down the line that there will be multi-ethnic mixes of people. But guess what's going to be the strongest gene drive in that mix? Okay, it's going to be us.
Can I respond to that?
Until we fix us, see, we are 300 years post Willie Lynch. But the effects of what he managed to do is a part of our DNA.
Exactly.
So regardless who we mix 10, 50, 100 years down the line with, what's in our DNA now, which was what it was in our DNA 300 years ago, is going to be in the DNA of those individuals 300 years from now.
Can I respond to that? Can I respond to that, Bree?
Sure. Well,
okay, here's the thing. My thing is, and when I talk about concern, first of all, things are moving at light speed, number one. If we do talk about DNA, we're talking about a whole other thing. First of all, no, I don't want to really – see, because the DNA thing and the race thing is weird. To me, it's a smokescreen to miss the bigger points of humanity, so to speak. Because we can play the race card, the black card, or whatever card we want to play, but at the end of the day, it's not 100 years. We're seeing it right now. Just like Brother Alex was talking about his neighbor and so forth and so on, this intermixing, and every time a black man and a black or white woman gets together, or Hispanic or Chinese or whatever, we're continuing to see a change in the face of what it means to be American, let alone to be any kind of specific self-culture within the general culture. So my thing, and even if you want to look at it from the standpoint of humanitarian thing, we can't love anybody, whether it be another person of my color or another person of another color, until I embrace and love who I am. And I got to come to some kind of basis. DNA-wise, heck, from Henry Louis Gates to all these other shows that are coming on TV, they're showing that our DNA is streaming through all kind of colors of people. So it's kind of hard to really play that whole thing to me. And that's my response to that.
I
want to say something. Our color is not the totality of our definition. We are a spiritual reality because of the environment that we have been. It is very distinct to be a spirit called an African American. The reason why I say that is because nobody else in this country has been enslaved by the system like we have. Nobody in this country has to deal with the psychological effects on our families as we have. And at this point in our
if I may, Dr. Hackley, for the listeners, what's being said is that we are the only race of people that were ever brought here against our will, in short.
I want to say something to that. Not only were we brought here against our will, but we were psychologically trained to stay here against our own will. We know better. We know that there can be better. We know that we can have better. But the challenge is that us knowing that we can have better, knowing that we can be better, and knowing that we can go further, we still have something within us that keeps us here, satisfied with this system and our place in this system, and we're constantly battling against that psychology, and that is something that I feel is the biggest battle. Even to this point, if we are to define ourselves scientifically, if we are to define ourselves economically, if we are to define ourselves socially, it still would not take away the spirit of struggle in our parents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents. If I was to say to my great-grandmother, who is alive at this point, that Grandma, I know that your grandmother was an Indian and your granddaddy was an African, but Grandma, we're not going to call you African-American anymore because we're going to call you African-American Indian. She's going to say, no, baby, I'm black. I've been the chairman of the chairwoman of the Deaconess Board all of these years. They are the ones that chased me down the dirt roads of Madison County, Virginia, and tried to kill me when I was a baby girl. I'm black, son. I'm going to be black till I die. Now, she might not have it politically correct. She might not have African-American as her fundamental thought, but she has the spirit of the matter straight. She knows what it is to stand up against Jim Crow. She knows what it is to have to sit in the back of the bus. She knows what it is to have to deal with the spirit of a country who is conditioned against her because of the color of her skin. Now, the key is that the color of our skin is not our problem. The color of our skin is someone else's problem that they've had with us. And if it's someone else's problem, we don't respond to the problem that we have with ourselves. We respond to the problem that someone else has with us. And then, on top of that, the psychological training that gives us the self-hatred that we encounter every day in our relationships, our professions, and in our educational system. So it's not just the DNA or the matter of science. This is the matter of the spirit of the whole matter. And if we're going to deal with culture, you can't deal with culture without dealing with the mysticism of spirit. And you have to deal with the unseen and the unknown that is there. Mm. We experience it every day, but we cannot explain the totality of it, but we know it's there. So the spirit of the matter is the reality that we're dealing with.
Okay.
Well, yeah. thank you for that.
Absolutely.
Also, we have on the line QB from Chicago. Quentin, are you still there?
Yes.
Okay. Do you have a question for the good doctor tonight or a comment?
Well, I'm 100%, 110% behind him. I don't have no question because I agree with everything that he's saying. And anybody that can't see that, you know, point blank, what we've been through as a people over the time period that we're talking about affects us, then something's wrong. That shows it right there.
And Brother QB, I have a question for you, Brother QB. I have a question for you, if I can. In Chicago is a very interesting place, strategic place. I've been there many times. Would you say that in Chicago, and I know that a lot of movements were founded there, would you say that the climate in Chicago right now for African Americans is one that could produce more potential leaders for this country as it concerns the mindset of how African Americans deal with each other? And the reason why I'm focusing on Chicago is I have certain beliefs about certain areas of the country, Chicago being one of them, being a climate, you know, climates for leaders to be born and raised. Would you say that it's a place that that can push out leaders?
Definitely. I definitely believe it is because of its history, yes, and the type of leaders that originated from here. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I appreciate that answer because I haven't really been able to ask that question to anyone from Chicago recently, but it just came to my mind. But I really have an appreciation because Chicago seems to live in a certain reality that has always addressed the challenges of the culture. And so I'm appreciative of everybody who has sacrificed their time and life and their mindset in Chicago for the struggle that we face nationally.
I have a question to all the listeners about a gentleman that supposedly called Obama the N-word, and that's been something that's on YouTube, and I don't know if anyone can address that.
I think his name is
Santorum.
I'm going to allow Alex to speak because Alex recently. Alex?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. You want to address these questions?
Well, he asked, "Is what's this about somebody on YouTube or whoever calling Obama the N-word?" What I want to say is this, is that it's blatantly obvious that there's no respect for this president because he is of color, okay? You got a white woman at the airport wagging her hand in his face, pointing her finger at his nose. You got a gentleman this week who calls him stupid. After he was elected, you had prominent newspapers in New York and all over the country doing cartoons of monkeys with his name on it, okay? You have all these different kind of things going on right now because he is of color. If that white woman had stuck her finger in Ronald Reagan's nose and
no, she wouldn't even been
nose,
on a tarmac.
She'd be disappearing. She'd be disappearing right now. She'd be gone.
She'd be gone.
The Secret Service would have lifted her off the ground, and we would have never heard from her again.
She'd be missing. She'd be missing. Yeah. Okay, this is the kind of stuff Obama had gave a speech about the recklessness of gambling and how it's destroying families and doing these different kind of things. And right after that, a little while after that, he caught a plane into Vegas. Okay, the plane lands, and the little white Jewish mayor wouldn't even come out to greet him when he came down. How you gonna go out there and greet a president you look at as an N-word? That's how he view you.
Yeah.
I hear what Brother Mark is saying, and there's a lot of valid points to what he's saying because we are intermingling a lot with this new generation. But what I think he's missing is that there is an obvious war, and there have always been a war, against the darker complected people of this country and even across the world. It's obvious that there's a war against that. If you're talking about going across seas to find some terrorists, you need to go back and look at Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma in 1921, and you tell me about terrorists. Mm. This country, this U.S. military, these white folks here went in and burned down an entire black town on purpose out of pure jealousy and hatred because they were affluent, they had their own businesses, they had mansions, and they went in there and burned the place down, and you got us going across cities looking for terrorists. Who are the terrorists? You answer that question for me. It doesn't matter to me if I got a couple of white girlfriends or whatever. People can marry whoever they want to marry. You can fall in love with whoever you want to fall in love with. That's not the issue. The issue is, if you love a white woman or a black woman, whatever the case is, why do you disassociate yourself from anything else that looks like you? That's the question. Not dating another culture or being involved with another culture, that's fine if you want to do that. But why do you disassociate yourself totally from anybody else that looks like you, that acts like you, like you're ashamed of it, like you're running from it? And we don't address that.
Okay. If I may, because I'm gonna, we're gonna take a commercial break. We're gonna come back and we're gonna take a rebuttal from Mark, and then I'm gonna ask Dr. Hackley to begin thinking about our next segment, which I want to talk about some solution based actions that we on the grassroots level can do to aid in, one, the deprogramming and reprogramming of ourselves individually as people of color in this country so that we can begin to really grow and prosper. So we're going to take a station break, and we'll be back in a moment.
Green Life Radio is a grassroots radio show offering a voice to everyday people. It is without a doubt that this service is a pleasure for we at Green Life to provide. However, this service comes at a cost. For us to continue to provide this valuable outlet to the community, we need your support. Join us as we raise funds to keep Green Life Radio streaming while we provide assistance to Public School 161 in Brooklyn, New York. 15% of all funds raised will go towards providing school supplies to the students of this necessary and vital educational institution. You can find more information about our fundraiser on the web at greelife.evenbright.com. That's greelife.evenbright.com.
And we're back. This is Bree Life Radio. If you just joined us, we are talking about what does it mean to be black in America now. We're joined tonight by the esteemed Dr. Hackley. And on the line with us, our guest caller panel is Mark from Houston, Texas. We have QB in Chicago, Illinois. And my correction, my brother Alex in Virginia Beach, who's experiencing very nice weather, mind you. So thank you all for returning. And where we left off, Alex was sharing his thoughts with the panel about how he was feeling about Mark's earlier comments. So I'm going to turn it over to Mark at this time to rebut. And then I'll give him a minute and a half to rebut, and then we're going to ask Dr. Hackley to share with us some solution-based ideas that we can possibly begin to exercise within the community on a grassroots level, because we can't have these discussions without ending on a note of solution. So, Mark?
Well, Well, I don't know where I would start. I'm going to try to get this in a minute and a half because it was something Dr. Hackley said and something Brother Alex.
Do
said.
Your
number
best.
One, number one, the spirit thing. I didn't even get into that because I would have loved to get into that, but I'll say this. I believe that, you know, God has not given me a spirit of fear, but a power of love and a sound mind. Therefore, I am a spirit, and my spirit strength is something that surpasses any carnal bondage that any man can put me in. Even when you look at the apostles from John, Paul, the rest of them who have been in prison, they found themselves to be free even in their imprisonment. So my thing is this. I understand about all these other particular obstacles that we go through, but when I was listening to the narrative of the grandmother going through the country situation back in the time, I am mindful of a history that brought us to where we are. Well, my point is this. At a certain point, we need to understand, and again, I come from a Christian basis, and I keep thinking about from a scriptural basis when it talks about what the weapons of my warfare are, number one. And I'm not going to go through all of them because I know brother knows what they are, and maybe the rest of you all do. But the issue is I got to find out what front I'm fighting whatever things are binding me. As a people. One thing about it is when it says, let your light so shine before men, they'll say your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. If any one of you all believe that you all can have a life that is reflective of freedom and you can show up to someone else, then you at that point have just entered into a position of power. Because what happens is they say, what manner of man is this? When they see you walk the way you walk, which is going to transcend race, it's going to transcend DNA, it's going to transcend all of those things. So that's basically what I'm saying. I'm saying we can get caught up in a race, and no one is saying it's not there. But if we're going to take it to the next level, we got to start looking at, as you say, the forces which are really binding, which are not of any color.
Okay, I'm going to comment to that real quick, and I'm going to turn that, and then we're going to turn it over to Dr. Hackley. My feeling, I hear all the scripture that you're quoting, and you know, I agree with the foundation of it, but here we are we're not talking about the Bible. We're talking about what it is to be black in America now, and for many of us. Because no one's imposing their perspective on you, but what some of us are saying is that we acknowledge that there is something greater than what is just even going on right now. It is the fact that we have a self-hatred going on amongst our people. And it is showing up in everything that we do. More importantly, it's showing up in how we interact with one another. And that I think that's the point that Alex was trying to get across. I think globally, that's the point that Dr. Hackley has referenced both here on the line and more specifically in the book. It's clear in the book that's what we're dealing with. Even though this happened to our people 300 years ago, it's still a part of who we are today. And I think that there's much repair that needs to go on, because if it doesn't take place, we're gonna continue to progress, because you know life is a part of progression. Every day we progress, but I think we will be limited to how far we can go until we deal with what's going on internally. And a lot of us are walking around in the dark, in denial. So having said that, Dr. Hackley, what would you suggest some of our some solutions to, one, some methods that can be utilized for deprogramming, so to speak. And then also I want to talk about, if we can get as much feedback from everyone on the line about the solution-based community grassroots things that need to take place daily, because once a year we celebrate for 30 days Black History Month. But Black History Month should be celebrated every day, because we're mm-hmm. Black every day. We're Black 365 days of the year. We're not Black only 30 days out of the year. So, you know, that's one thing I'd like to address. And then, you know, I hope that we can have enough time to get some good ideas and feedback from everyone. I know QB is on the line. He's being very patient. And then also I must have a moment to bring additional estrogen on the line. My good friend Gail from Minnesota, but we affectionately call her Turtle. So we've got to get her on the line. So if you could, Dr. Hackley, share some ideas with regards to the self-hatred component, and then let's talk about some solutions.
Yeah, I want to I absolutely want to do this. I want to say that in my book, I want to make this clear, I am a pastor. In my book, along with the 247 verses of Lynch's psychology, are 247 strategic verses of Scripture that deal with the spiritual dimension of the reality in which we face every day. Now, you said solution. Jesus called 12, and when he called the 12, one of his first instructions in the book of Matthew is that they go not first to the world, but they go first to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Now, all of these brothers were Jewish. All of these brothers were of the house of Israel. And basically, Jesus is telling them, don't go to the world. Don't go after everybody else first. Go and save your own house first. Go and save your own people. Deal with the people on your corner. Deal with the people with your issue. Deal with the people who talk like you, think like you, buy food where you buy it. And when he dealt in parables, he dealt culturally. He dealt with the situation that was at hand. Even though it addressed the people globally, he dealt locally and he dealt culturally. And the scripture says in Psalm 82, Arise, O God. Psalm 82, verse 8, it says, Arise, O God, judge the earth, for thou shalt inherit all nations. A part of God inheriting the nation, or in part of the spiritual matter of the nations becoming a spiritual people, is the distinction of each nation that's founded based on the cultural authenticity. Now, I have no control over the customs that have been developed that are called Asian customs. And I have no control over the customs that have been developed that are called Chinese customs that are on the continent of Asia or Europe, and then the customs that are developed in London or the specific points in London. But what I do have a connection to are places like Nigeria and places like that I've been to where the people singing Swahili, and when they say, Ey Yahweh Kumamai, and they begin to say, God is good, he's good, in their own language, he's a mighty man in battle, El Shaddai. When they begin to say things and seeing things in their language, it's not just a spiritual experience, it's the authenticity of the culture that touches me when I'm with those people. Even when I'm in the European persuasion or the Eurocentric church, their distinction of worship, or what they call worship, those things become they're therapeutic for that experience. And so everybody has a right to authenticity. That's the other thing I want to bring across. We have to, if we're going to solve this thing, we must first assert our right to authenticity. We are African American. What does that mean? African. We're too African to be fully American. And we're too American to be fully African. What do I mean by that? We don't have enough paper to trace our history completely backward to the authenticity of where our actual blood came from. And we don't have enough money in America to trace our future forward so that we can say that 10 generations from now, all of our families are going to be taken care of. We don't have that on paper. We might have that by faith, but we don't have that on paper. And so the reality of these situations make us authentic in how we address this particular issue. And when we address this particular issue with solution, and the other thing that I say in this book is this book is based on solution-oriented stimuli. Everybody's talking about the problem. I'm not just talking about the problem in this book. I offer principles. There are also 247
my babes. I call them Yabe. And Yabe is a play that I wrote for children between the ages of ages 6 and ages 14. We had a performing arts summer camp where we dealt with the Willie Lynch letter, and we called the play Yabe. And it said, I am young, alive, black, and empowered. That's what it stands for, young, alive, black, and empowered, Yabe. Young, alive, black, and empowered, Yabe. And the kids would chant that, and they would say, the letter said that I couldn't be a good father, but then they came in and said, the curse is broken. Not only am I going to be a great father, but I'm going to be a progenitor of generations, and I'm going to have a legacy, and I'm going to write books. And the children would make declarations. First of all, if we're going to change our migration toward enslavement, we're going to have to change our meditation. And what do we mean by changing our meditation? We don't mean ignoring the reality of our past, and we don't mean ignoring the reality of our present, but we have to address the solution by being realistic about the real problem. Nobody can change history, but everybody can make history. But if someone doesn't know their history, they are going to find themselves repeating history. And so we must be aware of our history, and we must respond to the symptoms strategically. This Lynch thing is not a curse, as people would say. It's not just a curse or spiritually a curse, but it is a psychological, scientific disorder that deals with programming at all levels, from the scientists, from the executive, the CEOs, down to the man that sweeps the streets, up to the man that's in prison but brilliant, down to the man that is behind the desk making six figures, great job, but very much distant from his experience, distant from himself. And so if we're going to deal with solution-oriented stimuli, we're going to have to get back to the point. I am black, and that's great. I am African-American. That's an awesome thing to be. I have a strategic experience that I have inherited through the generations of my family, and that's something to be celebrated. And while we're celebrating, we are yet preparing. There are, like I said, 247 teaching experiences, things that people can go out. I go as far as to say, go find somebody on your street corner, a single mother who is struggling, and shower her with about a $200 shower of things that may help the single mother that you know in your community. Just the therapy for her mind, things of that nature. Or find a father and empower his manhood. Do something to develop his sense of pride in who he is and responsibility. But there are so many things. I can't even get through the entire book, but you have to get the book to get the reality. But I make specific strategic instruction on how to empower a consciousness for the development of our culture in the future, because we need to go through a renaissance. I tell people we were going through a renaissance in Harlem during the time, and I know that you know, because New Yorkers can have an appreciation for this. There was a renaissance going on in Harlem. Had it not been for that war, the civil rights movement might have happened then, because we were so progressive and there were so many Nat King Coles, and the people of that time were so progressive, and Madam C.J. Walker in their economics and things of that nature in their development, that we became distracted by war. As a country, but then at the same time, the civil rights movement really manifested itself through Dr. King and my great brother X and some of the other people who have come through the movement. What I do have a suggestion to everybody is whatever the challenge is in your personal home, in your space, in your family, in your community, in your culture, do something to not oppose the person, not oppose the carrier of the symptom, but do something that is that causes resolution to the symptom. If you're dealing with a someone who is speaking contentiously or always having a problem with you, a sister or a brother, and they're always angry, the scripture says that a soft answer turneth away wrath. You don't have to go pound for pound, round for round. We know who you can be at your worst. We know that what you can do at your worst. But who are you at your best? And the thing that Lynch, I want to say this before, the thing that Lynch says, he says, what I want to warn you about is that the spirit of the people have the possibility of correcting them, and a phenomena could occur that could reshift the roles. what Lynch was afraid of. He gave us the solution to the problem, actually, in his letter. The solution is solution-oriented phenomena. And when I say phenomena, I don't mean do it one day, one time, for one person at one given, and say, I did good today and feel good about yourself. I'm saying do it so much that a hurricane of goodness is coming out of your life, that it causes the winds of change in your community, so much so that it's almost selfless. You have to, if people died and they sacrificed their blood in order to see change coming up to this place, we also have to do the same thing to see a psychological change. But that's what I want to say.
Okay. I want you to hold on the line, Dr. Hackley, because I'm going to bring our good friend Gail from Minnesota, more affectionately known as Turtle, on, and I know she has something to say. She probably wanted to ask you a question. Gail. Sister Gail.
Hello there, everybody.
Turtle. Well, this is Dr. Hackley. I'd like to introduce you to my sister, Gail from Minnesota.
Well, hello, Dr.
Hi, Sister Gail. How are you, Sister Turtle? Turtle, that's what we call you around the corner.
I am blessed, such as everyone else. Well, I really don't have a question because I really like hearing you speak. You know, it's a beautiful thing. The only thing that I see when looking at solutions is that it needs to be a way to bring the message to those who don't have radios, those who are in the streets, and that's the only thing that I see. I see we do a lot of talking and our radio shows and talk shows, but not the ones who need to be listening, their ears aren't there. So we can look at ways to bring that message to the streets and enlighten and educate the ones who, you know, that we feel that are a little more fallen and not capable of the mindset that we have, to bring them up to level and up to speed on the things, the laws, their rights, and all that, then we could probably push some of this stuff even further. That's all I really have to say.
Good.
Yeah,
well,
I want to respond to, can I say something to Gail?
Absolutely.
Gail, you have brought up such an amazing point. The government every year gives out money for what they call humanitarian efforts and things of that nature. They give it to universities and things of that nature. But this past year, and I'm not sure what happened, but Clark Atlanta University, I spoke there in the past year and even this year, and Morehouse. And while I was there, it was presented to me a grant for, I want to say, $2 million to be shared amongst several groups or whatever, or something, and this grant says that they wanted people to deal with a specific culture development issues or things that deal with, it could deal with any culture, it could be a Latino, it could be African American, whatever, culture development issues that lean to the course of humanitarian aid, one, two, but it had to be something that could be technologically savvy, like they were encouraging children to create video games that taught about the issue, or encouraging people to create phone apps that address the issue, things like that. We have to not only talk about it on radio shows, and we have to not only talk about it on television, but we have to keep up with the speed of technology, and we have to begin to move at the speed of Brother Wade. He says at the speed of light. We have to move at the speed of life. We have to move at the speed of life. We have to move at the speed of light and begin to find a way to get this message into every possible medium that we can. I know that one sister called me last week, and she said, Dr. Hackley, every time I see somebody with a problem, I go into back to the website, I buy the book, and I send them the book. And I said, I thank you, sister, because that is helping the cause, but at the same time, it's helping the cause. One thing that's great about people who are writers, I'm not just putting myself there. If you have a thought, you ought to put something on paper. You ought to put something
on paper as a testament and a will and a testament to who you are, what you're doing. Even movie makers have a script. There's something on paper, and so we need to have that thing. That thing on paper, because some people die with great thoughts or solutions in their mind, and we never get a chance to experience them. And so I write, and so I encourage other people to write, and I try to be as technologically savvy as possible. But we're working on getting this book into ebook, so that people can download that. We are trying to make sure that it's something that is audiobook ready. And give people something they can listen to in their cars with the book. But you gotta exhaust every medium with your message. Exhaust every medium. We are a people who are multiplicitly gifted, and we have to begin to utilize the creativity that has come through our necessity over the years, and master being in the streams that are most visible and most. That most attention is being paid to in the society of our day.
Which is a perfect segue into something that I wanted to say. You know, at a grassroots level, I see the need in the community. And Dr. Hackley, you and I, we kind of talked about this earlier this afternoon. In Crown Heights, where Alex and I grew up, when we were children, there were a lot of after-school activities and organizations that we had the chance to be able to tap into. We had summer programs that we were able to tap into. As a matter of fact, my brother and two of my cousins, they chaired the PAL after-school and summer program at Mega Evers College for several years. My aunt, she was the president of Mega Evers College, and I had another aunt that was an educator of she was actually the director of nursing education at Mega Evers. So my family has a rich academic history in the community, and also working with young children. I guess that is where I get my public service seed, so to speak, and feeling the need to want to reach out to and advocate for young people and old people. There was a senior citizen organization that was very strong in Crown Heights at the time. But I find now that there are no community-based organizations. And even, like I was mentioning, I used to be a Brownie and a Girl Scout. I used to be a participant in a youth group at St. Mark's Episcopal Church on Union Street in Crown Heights. These are the things that I had the good fortune to participate in that helped shape and mold me, you know, and gave me things to do. We don't have these types of organizations, and I've been very candid with you, and I know you being a Thessalonian and a pastor, I've been very candid with you in saying that I feel that our community-based churches have really dropped the ball with some of the leadership and helping organize in programs that would benefit children. And then another point I want to make, so that you can maybe have an opportunity to touch on another solution that we need to come up with, and I think this is a global solution for people of color, is that, you know, God help their souls. I mean, you know, Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, and civil rights leaders that are still alive today but that are of that civil rights movement in the 60s that are still with us. They're not going to be with us much longer. And most of us on the line here, we're in our 40s.
Okay.
Who are we going to – who's going to take the baton and lead us? And also, what would you suggest for mentoring young people in our communities so that they would pick up the initiative to become activists in their communities and to take on some leadership? Another thing that I did And I don't know, I can't remember if Alex also worked there. One of my first jobs before I went to corporate America working on Wall Street, I worked at the Bedford Stuyvesant Restoration Association that Jesse Jackson was affiliated with.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these were political things that my parents got me involved with when I was younger. What you know, if you could just address some of the things that I've thrown on the table, you know, with regards to community-based organizations, the church, and leading us into the next 25 years and how we're going to develop these young children's minds to take up the role of being public servants and advocates on our behalf.
Well, I want to say this about the church. The church is going through a very big change and evolution in its self-definition due to the advances in information technology, due to the advances in what we call modernization as far as denominationalism comes. There are so many people that are non-denominational, interdenominational, and then there are people who are tradition in their denomination. But the challenge that comes in this season is that we find that when we say the church now, the water scale, there is a very much bigger picture to the definition of church due to the expansion of just information. And so what I like to advise or encourage is that we, as spiritual people in the church, not just define church by the places that we go, but we define church by who we are, what kind of lifestyle we manifest to the community, which ties into saving the children, which ties into saving the seed. Somebody said, "What about the leaders? Who is the leader? Who will the leaders be for the next generation?" My pastor, my deceased pastor, Bishop Albert Key, would say, "You know, fellowship is the only ship that won't sink." And so, what I got out of that is when I'm looking for leaders, we have to get in a place where we're not necessarily looking for individual leaders, but we're building the ship of leaders. We're building the group of people, or we're building the consciousness or the overall generality of the consciousness of those who are around us in mass capacity. Because nobody cares now about who the actual voice is, because the corporate conglomerate behind the voice is so powerful that they can put a voice up today and bring one down tomorrow. And so what we have to do is we have to build the ship. We have to build the relationship of leaders, and that's in the church, and that's also in relationship to the culture. One of the things that's distinct about my ministry is the name of our ministry is Kingdom Culture International, and my objective is to cause the kingdom of God, or to try to invest the kingdom of God into the mediums of culture, so that the kingdom of God can be not only a force that is reckoned with in the spirit realm, but a force that's reckoned with in the earth realm. If there's going to be a negative influence or connotation in the videos, there ought to be a positive influence in the connotation in the videos. If there's going to be not only a positive connotation, but there also ought to be a relevant relevance of how we get to the negative connotation. How did we get to the videos that degrade the women and things of that nature? How did we get to that place? And so there has to be validity given to that. Not only that, but in when it concerns solution-oriented stimuli, in this season of our lives, where our Jesse Jacksons, our Al Sharpton, our people who are becoming aged, our Maya Angelous, these people who have walked through the movement, marched, and they're beginning to find themselves at rest, find themselves challenged with sickness and things of that nature. We have to draw close
to wisdom while it is making its transition. If we don't draw close to wisdom, we're going to suffer the same challenges that we have suffered in times past. We must draw close to wisdom. When we draw close to wisdom, we will find ourselves saving our own selves time, hassle, bad fortune, all of these things, I mean, things that come against us. We will find ourselves saving ourselves from a lot of the trouble. We don't listen to our parents when we're in our teens because we have the pride of our, you know, organs and testosterone and hormones and all of that kind of stuff. And we don't start listening until about 30 or 40. But the key to all of that goes is that if we can get our children to listen earlier. And what do I mean by listen earlier? We cannot be so abrasive to their strong wills because we put strong wills in them. We made them decisive by letting them choose what they wanted on the menu at McDonald's. We made them temperamental by letting them say, I feel like I want to do this today, or you feel like you want to do this, Johnny? Yes, I feel like I want to do this. We have created those challenges that we deal with, but now that we've created one, we have to learn how to utilize utilize their power and utilize their strength and utilize their conditioning for positive medium so that they take that decisiveness, they take that strong willness, they take that discernment, they take those things into the culture, and they begin to play hardball like the kids from Asia come over and migrate over here. They play hardball like the kids that migrate up from South America. Those people are not coming to play nice with the culture. If it's you and them for the job, they're going for the job and they're going for the whole company, and that's nothing personal. And it's nothing against you. It's just what they're going to do to preserve their culture. I heard someone say that we have to have the love of God. Yes, we have to have the love of God, but we also have to do as Jesus said and be shrewd as serpents, but yet harmless as doves. We have to be people who are assertive about who we are. We're aggressive about who we are and what we do, and we make our stamp on time and make our stamp on society so that it cannot be ignored or denied. When Marcus Garvey got too popular in this country, they begin to bring accusation against him. The only thing that killing our leaders does, it does one of two things. Either it put fear in people, or it put the kind of tenacity or faith or confidence in people that says, we're going further. You can kill the body, but you cannot kill the mind. You can kill the situation. And people have to say that I'm going to pick up the mantle that have been left in the earth, the mindset, the truths that were given to us that people have tried to program us to ignore. We have to pick those things back up, pick those messages back up, go back to the challenges between W.E.B. Du Bois, the challenges of someone like a James Weldon Johnson. We have to go back to the dimensions of truth that came to us through a time where we were confronting the system, where we were speaking truth to power. We have to pick up those things, and then we have to get a revelation or begin to open our ears to those who have an answer for today. No matter how young, no matter how old they are, there's a brother that I know by the name of George Mullins. He is starting a nonprofit program in this area of Northeast Washington, D.C., where we live, and he's working with children on a regular basis on the local level, on the house level, things of that nature. George Mullins is at Georgetown University, and he's getting ready to go to medical school, and he's a veteran from the military. And he's using his power, his own power, to start in his community, on his street, the things that are necessary for the people that he sees on a daily basis to make the change locally. You cannot keep walking out your door and ignoring the reality of the disparity that's going on around you. If you keep walking out your door and ignoring it, it is going to soon be knocking at your door. And that's the key. Right. We get angry when it's knocking at our door, but we have to get angry when we see it outside of our door and say we're going to address the spirit of the matter.
Okay, well, Dr. Hackley, that was definitely enlightening, and I want to thank you at this time for participating in our discussion. I want to invite you to come back to Bree Life Radio Show anytime you want. Know that this is going to be a three-part series conversation, so we will be picking this conversation back up next Wednesday at 9 o'clock. In closing, I want to thank all the guest callers, Mark from Houston, Texas, Gail from Minnesota, more affectionately known as Turtle, QB in Chicago, Alex in Virginia, and I want to thank all the listeners for calling in. This has been a very informative show. I want to invite everyone to listen in next week as we have part two to what does it mean to be black in America now. You can send your questions, concerns, and, of course, your constructive criticisms to relifradio@gmail.com. I want to thank you again. Peace and blessings. Have a wonderful week. And then also call in tomorrow to the Bree Life Radio Show because it will be Freestyle Thursdays. So you know how we do it on Thursday. So peace and blessings and good night, everyone.
Faggin' echoes, so if you ain't fragile, through the net connection, we streaming you to Mexico.